Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, our Friday weekend edition of the Bulwark Podcast, which always tends to be our most popular. And our episode today is brought to you by Plexiderm. And our guest today is Tim Miller, who is a contributor to the Bulwark and pretty much a man about town. By the way, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it, Tim.
Yeah, Charlie, I like being on the weekend podcast. Yeah. I can have a whiskey beforehand and, you know, we can let loose a little bit.
Well, that is good. Although, what time is it? You're in California, right?
So well, 9:35. Like it was a breakfast.
9:30. Wow. See, Michael Steele and I once talked about, you know, getting through the Trump era with day drinking, but I don't think we were going that early. I think we were talking about a gin and tonic at maybe 11.
But, tough times, you know, out there. You just wake up and look at the Twitter, and sometimes you just need to put a little maker's mark in the coffee.
Well, I was actually in D.C. this week, and I was talking with our, you know, producer, Jim Swift, and I said, you know, our Friday weekend podcast is always our most listened to podcast, so we need to, like, you know, up our game and just, you know, begin to think of the Friday podcast as the most important podcast of the week. This is, like,
so
internal
stuff. So I was
the
obvious call.
So, yeah, so, you know, apparently, you know, he puts down the phone, and he's on the line to you, so, hey.
I bring the ratings, Charlie. I bring the ratings. Okay, let's do this.
We have to clear up this first rumor. You did not actually dress up as Pierre Delecto for Halloween. That is fake news.
That is fake news. I wish that I had. But we did not go as Delecto. We already had a family plan where my daughter dressed as Jasmine and her cousins dressed as the Raja the Tiger and Abu. So we were very much in Aladdin theme, and I think it would have been odd for me to jump in as Delecto. But yeah. I did see the Tag Romney's Kid tweet, and it was, I think, maybe the only thing that brought me joy on Twitter all week, possibly, was the picture of Mitt's grandchild dressed as Delecto. He did such a marvelous job, I couldn't have competed anyway.
I very seldom get real joy out of, actually, that's not true. I was going to say no joy out of Twitter. Every once in a while, there's going to be a great dog video or, you know, elephants in Africa or something like that, or this guy named Paul Bronx has some good stuff. I get joy, you know, from that sort of thing. Usually it's just sort of a sick sort of entertainment. So I want to talk about a lot of things with you today, including Elizabeth Warren. She's out with her, her plan to pay for Medicare for All, which is, a $20 trillion tax increase, a $52 trillion spending package. We also have a piece up on the Bulwark from basically an email from some deep state guy who is making the case about how she's going to lose to Donald Trump. I'm going to get your take on all that, of course. Today is the day after the hangover from the impeachment vote yesterday. And I also want to get your take on this Katie Hill, because I'm going to confess right off the bat, I am squishy on all of this. I've avoided thinking about it because it was one of those things where I think I don't have to have an opinion, so therefore I'm not going to, which is really liberating. Except now
it is nice.
It is sort of nagging though, because I have this sort of reflexive, you know, thing like, you know, I should have a take, but I have no takes on this right now. And yes, I did look at the pictures. But let's start off with a piece that you wrote, which is really.
I'm just going to clarify right up front. I obviously did not look at the pictures.
Okay, so why would that be obvious?
Have any take on that. I mean, my general proclivities are not to naked women pictures, I guess, to start with. But, Katie Hill naked pictures weren't really on the top of my surfing list.
It wasn't on the top of my, okay, you know, I took a bad click.
We've all been there.
Because it turns out that it was not my proclivities either. But we'll just move on here. Okay, so let's move on to, you know, big public policy issue. Fascinating, you know, it's a we're going to get to impeachment. We'll get to Trump stuff. But we had this moment this week where we were once again having the perennial debate about student athletes, whether student athletes should be compensated. And rather amazingly, the NCAA decided to change the policy and decided that that student athletes should be able to enter the free market and be compensated for their images and likenesses. And almost immediately, a Republican U.S. Senator, Richard Burr, who we often say nice things about, came forward and said that we ought to penalize any of these student athletes who earn money from the private sector by creating a completely new tax on their scholarships. Now, you know, I again, this is another issue where I've gone back and forth between whether or not the college athletes should be paid. I think the fact that there's so much money in college sports and that they are clearly exploited makes a strong case for this. But you made the point in The Bulwark, which I thought was really interesting. Once upon a time, Mr. Miller, you wrote, it would have been kind of crazy to hear that a Republican senator was proposing a new tax in response to the news that a class of citizens would be given access to the free market. But if we've learned anything about the Republican-oriented body politic over the past few years, it was the folly of believing what the base wanted was zombie Adam Smith or free markets or true conservatism. So you put this in this context of what the hell is happening to Republicans. So let's let me know what tripped your trigger with Senator Burr?
Well, yeah, first, this is a longtime hobby horse of mine. I have two quasi-political hobby horses, paying college athletes and not falling back, having permanent daylight savings time. Nobody wants to come home in the dark from work when they want to take their kids to the park. But we don't need to argue about that today. But I will say
that twice a year, though. So this is good time.
We're closed. Yeah. I pledged that I would support any presidential candidate that supported both. I'm sad to report that Jeb and I had a couple of heated plane arguments because he was on the opposite side of me on both issues. It didn't cause me to revoke my support for him. But
Jeb was heated on these issues?
I was heated, I guess. Let's just say, because they're my hobby horses. Okay. And he was very calm and disagreeing with me on both points.
Okay, but that's what my picture was, you being heated and him being sort of a little low energy about it.
Yeah, that's a good correction. He was very, I don't know, low energy. I reject the term, but I think he was very even keel, I will say, in his opposition to me on both points. So it's been a long time, hobby horse. I was excited to see the news, right? This was, you know, it was like the Pierre Delecto tweet. You're looking at the internet in 2019, you see good news. The NCAA finally, you know, came to their senses, at least on one element of this, letting these players sell their name and likeness, let them get royalties from the video games or sign a jersey if they want to, just like any other kid on campus. And within, it was so fast. This is the other thing. It was within literally an hour of the announcement, Richard Burr had fired off this tweet. And the thing that got me riled up was, you know, in addition to just the absurdity of being mad about this as a ostensible conservative, the phrasing he used, it was we need to penalize these guys for quote unquote cashing in if they choose to cash in. And I thought to myself, this is like Bernie Sanders type language, right? Like, we're getting mad at somebody for what is more American than being able to sign your name on a jersey and get money for it?
He's been hanging out with Josh Hawley and all these guys. Right. We may be Republicans, but we hate capitalism as much as AOC.
Exactly, and so that's really where I went with in the article. And I think that you look at a person like Burr, who is, you know, a traditional, you know, country club kind of Republican. Somebody me and him probably don't disagree on too much. But you know, as the party changed in 2016, and I think as a lot of these guys saw, you know, what they thought to be true about the party wasn't true, which what the voters wanted, and or maybe not what the voters wanted, but what the voters emphasized, what the issues they actually cared about were, wasn't actually, you know, fiscal responsibility or, you know, free markets and, you know, liberty, conservatism. What you know, it really was. You know, kind of the other side of the coin of identity politics, but it was white identity politics. And so they were riled up about, you know, building the wall and jailing Hillary. And, you know, these were the things that turned them on. And so I think that a lot of senators, a lot of Republican candidates are kind of looking at this now and saying, I'm feeling a little uncertain, right? So like, how can I appeal to these folks in ways that, I agree with, or at some level, but that, you know, actually, you know, gets them excited, because, you know, the old path of cut taxes, cut spending, you know, protect babies, like, that isn't working anymore, you know? And so I saw him jump out on this issue as kind of an example of that, which is similar to what, like you said, Hawley has done and what others, you know, have done, what you see from Tucker Carlson. And frankly, in this case in particular, you know, I saw a pretty big underlying sense of racism in trying to get upset about, yeah, well, certainly racial grievance, right? I mean, why?
Well, there are a lot of white college athletes.
Are there in football and basketball in the big sports where the kids are going to actually make money on this? There aren't that many white college athletes. There are some, but it is the preponderance of the football and basketball players are African American or people of color. And look, I don't.
Okay,
I'm not saying
you,
that,
you, mentioned, I'm not white, saying, you but, mentioned white identity politics, yeah. And then you threw in jailing Hillary Clinton. But I mean, Hillary Clinton, you don't have to have white identity politics to want to throw Hillary Clinton in jail, right? I mean,
sure, but
she's the whitest woman in America, right? I mean,
yeah, of course.
Look, married to the first black president, but still, you know, Hillary.
I'm lumping that in with what I would call grievance conservatism, right? And I think that there's a spectrum here. And so, look, I'm not saying the argument that I'm not trying to make in this article is that everybody who thinks that college athletes shouldn't get paid is a racist. Like, that's crazy. You know, that's basically just the other side of the coin of identity politics. What I'm saying is that I think what is animating voters right now in this time is making sure that people in the other tribe get their comeuppance. Right. And sometimes there's a racial element to that. Sometimes there isn't, right? In the case of Hillary Clinton or the Hollywood elites or, in some cases now we're seeing like the Republicans being upset about the big bankers.
Yeah. Just basically so politics is basically about either punishing or provoking tears from people you don't like. So there's no underlying freedom agenda or free market. Which also explains why these principles seem so free floating, why they're adopted one day and then rejected the next day. It really is about the grievance and the resentment. And if you understand that that's the Rosetta Stone, there's a certain consistency to this.
Absolutely.
There's a certain consistency to the complete inconsistency.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what is going to make the libs cry more, you know, in some cases. What is going to make the, you know, people from the other tribe more upset or get their comeuppance? And so what I wrote in this article is what for a lot of these people, it's, look, they're folks that like college sports. They watch college sports. They either have student loan debts or they're paying, you know, for their kids to go to college and it's expensive and it's bleeding them dry and it's annoying to them. Right, that they're like, hey, these guys in the other tribe who should be grateful for the fact that we're giving them this very, you know, lavish scholarship, they're now trying to cash in on this, right? They're now trying to, you know, get more than they deserve, and there is an element there. I think there's an underlying racial element to it, but I just think that there's this element of, we need to make sure that we're punishing people who are from the other tribe. Yeah. And if you look in this instance, California was the one that did the bill. The big names supporting it are people like LeBron James. You know, like I said, the athletes are mostly coming from, you know, different communities. And so it's pretty easy to see assume which side of the coin in our tribal politics there.
Yeah, what I find extraordinary about all of this is how much money there is in NCAA sports these days. As you point out, you know, the March Madness tournament is a $1 billion event. I mean, they have these corporate champions and sponsors. I mean, it is ridiculous. You have CBS paying $55 million for the right to air, you know, one game for 15 weeks. I mean, it's just crazy. You go through almost every state. I'm guessing that probably it's somewhere like 48 to 50 of the 50 states. If you found who is the top paid, you know, government employee, it would probably be the coach of the football team or the basketball team. I mean,
it's a little bit less than that because of states like Vermont and Maine and stuff that don't have big sports. But yeah, it's over half of the states that do. And it is, I said in the piece, I was, you know, a big LSU fan. Part of the reason I think maybe I'm so excited or amped up about this issue is because like of the guilt I feel about enjoying watching these, you know, sports, which I do, where these guys are getting, you know, basically taken advantage of, but
they,
you know,
get scholarships. The argument is, they are compensated. They get scholarships. They get a college education.
Yeah, but it's pennies on the dollar. Yeah, it's pennies on the dollar for what they're worth in the free market. I mean, that is basically the Soviet argument, right? That, like, you know, you do the work and then we give back to you what we think you deserve. That isn't how this should work. I mean, these guys are valued at much higher than that. And if you watch these games now, you know, the LSU game this past weekend, the commercials are interminable. And they add commercials when it's the big game so that the networks can make their money and so the schools can make money off this. And you know, the thing is, the folks who want to argue this, which I understand on kind of nostalgia grounds or traditional grounds, which is, hey, we don't want money to ruin these games that we love. I get that, but the problem is it's too late, and I don't understand why the only people they want to punish are the players, right? It would be consistent, at least ideologically, but not consistent in the framework that you laid out, Charlie, about who's on the other side of the coin, to say, okay, well, let's fix this by saying the coaches should get paid less, and let's get rid of the ads, and, you know, let's put the games on PBS, right? Okay, you know, if you want to sort of roll back the clock and make this pure amateurism, that's fine. But as it is, it's an entirely corporate enterprise in which the only people who aren't making money off it are the largely poor and largely, you know, black players who are competing in the games.
See,
it's
I think that's the obnoxious element of this that. That senators like Burr, and I don't want to beat up on him too much, but you know, senators like Burr are offended that these student athletes might be getting some benefit, but they're not offended by the incredible corporate spending and corporate profits of all of this. Nobody has suggested a tax on NCAA sponsorships. Nobody has suggested an extra tax on all of this. Okay, so
or the coaches. I'm sure he's friends with the North. Like Dean Smith is a Republican. I'm sure they're pals. Why shouldn't we jack up Dean's taxes? No, that'd be Elizabeth Warren's plan. He's on the other side from her, right?
Okay, so let's get deep into the let's go deep into the rabbit hole of.
Can we just before we get on Elizabeth Warren? Can we have a pause for our NCAA sponsor, which is the official net of the NCAA, where the players go up the ladder and they cut down the net. And I think maybe and there's an official nylon net at the NCAA. So maybe we should take a quick pause in our podcast to appreciate all those sponsors.
And we do appreciate that. So let's go deeper into American populism with Elizabeth Warren. Okay, so we have a piece up on the Bulwark on Friday. It's an email to Jonathan Lass, basically making the case how Elizabeth Warren is going to manage to lose to Donald Trump. And she says, "What do you think will happen? Whoever this is, what do you think will happen when Republicans get to frame the election as a choice between center-right populist economics on the one hand and progressive socialist economics? Not because that's the best ground for them to fight on, but because it is exactly the battle the Democrats ask for. Elizabeth Warren wants to take away your health insurance. Elizabeth Warren wants to force your kids into failing schools. Elizabeth Warren wants to raise your taxes for government-run health care and government-run education." And she basically put a price tag on that of like $20 trillion over the next decade. Who do you trust to make the best medical and education decisions for your household, your doctors, and your family, or Elizabeth Warren's government? Is Warren going to be able to defend this ground successfully? Maybe, but does she really want to? You have a somewhat different take on all this. I have to tell you, I'm in the camp of Elizabeth Warren is like sitting around thinking, how do I lose to a guy whose approval rating is down to 38%, who is a chronic liar, who is losing support among independents, even among Republicans? What could I possibly do? I don't know. Why don't I throw out numbers like $52 trillion for health care, and we haven't even gotten to the Green New Deal and all my free college education and other woke stuff I have out there. So I'm looking at Elizabeth Warren, and I'm thinking, these guys are going to F this up. They are just going to F it up. But you have a different take on this.
Well, they certainly
convince
might F
me
it
I'm
up.
Wrong.
So I don't have a different take on that. They certainly might F it up. Here was my thing when I was reading the article, which you know Jonathan Last sort of transcribed from Deep State Bob, his friend, in the board today. And I was reading it, and I'm thinking, you know, I probably agree with Deep State Bob on every issue. And I think that if Elizabeth Warren is trying to appeal to me and Deep State Bob and Charlie and probably a lot of people who are listening to this podcast, like his advice is probably right. But just as from a strategic standpoint, I don't know that he is. And let me tell you why. So look, I would prefer that the Democrats would put up Joe Biden, a moderate Democrat that would make it easy for me to vote for them. But I don't know if I am the core voter that they are looking for. Maybe they are. But if it's Elizabeth Warren is the nominee, I think that there are two other categories of voters that are more important for them. That is people that voted for Barack Obama and then changed to Donald Trump, mostly blue collar union types, and voters who either didn't vote or voted for Jill Stein, you know, which are largely voters of color and younger millennial voters. If you look at those two categories, which are bigger than the Romney McMullen or Romney Clinton categories, which aren't nothing, by the way, it's about 4% of the electorate, but it's still smaller than the Obama Trump and the people who didn't vote categories. Are they really, you know, going to be moved by an argument about Donald Trump and norms and Donald Trump and lies and Donald Trump and being crazy? I think they all already knew that in 2016, right? And so I think that it's possible that Warren's best strategic play. Now, this is unique to Warren. I'm not making the argument this is the Democrats' best strategic play, but it's like if we assume Warren's going to win, her best strategic play might be to just out-populist him. To say, look, Donald Trump promised all you guys that he was going to, you know, not do Paul Ryan economics and that he was, you know, anti-Goldman Sachs. And remember his closing ad about, you know, kind of draining the swamp and the kind of weirdly anti-Semitic, evil foreign powers. He didn't do any of those things. He put a bunch of Goldman Sachs execs in his cabinet. He passed a big tax cut that skewed towards, you know, more wealthy Americans and towards businesses. And you know, he hasn't followed through on anything tangible that helped your lives. I'm going to do that. I'm going to give you all the goodies. You know, I'm going to actually disrupt Washington in the way that he promised you that he would. And these bankers actually hate me more than him. And all the people that you hate actually hate me more than him. And that I'm the real disruptor. To me, if she is able to execute that message in a general election, that I think is probably going to yield a better result for her than trying to appeal to a bunch of, you know, never Trump cucks who have already kind of made their mind on Trump, us, right? Mm-hmm. So for us, like she's trying to win us over versus like throwing our vote away, right? Voting for writing somebody in, writing in Zombie Reagan, right? She's trying to win us over. And maybe she could still, even with liberal policies, because what all of us are going to decide, no matter who the nominee is, the calculus that all of us are going to make is, okay, Donald Trump is completely unfit on every possible imaginable level. The other Democratic candidates' policies are worse. Can I stomach them enough to vote for them, or should I just throw my vote away? And so she's probably going to lose some people who are making that calculus, but I just don't know if the math is the same. Does that make sense?
No, it does. And this was the case made by somebody else we've had on the podcast. I think it was Kyle Kondik from Sabato's Crystal Ball made exactly the same point.
I'm so happy. I was nervous there when you said somebody else made the point.
No.
It's a smart person. Because
he was arguing that she actually, you know, was more able to get to the, you know, out populist Trump, and that may be a sweet spot. My concern is that she's got some disadvantages in being more populist, you know, including the, you know, the Harvard professor. I am the whole middle school vice principal vibe that she gives off. Not to mention the sort of scary revolutionary stuff. Like, people like the idea of change, but they don't necessarily like the idea of massive disruption. These numbers are just so huge. The proposal to wipe out all private health insurance, that's disturbing. And, you know, you've been around campaigns enough to know exactly what Republicans will do with this. Mm-hmm. That there are a lot of issues that may poll well in the abstract, but in the heat of a campaign, when, for example, the Green New Deal is characterized as a, you know, massive increase of government regulation that will kill manufacturing jobs, that suddenly those numbers can switch dramatically. You know, that she is talking about raising taxes by $20 trillion. Yes, it's on the rich, but I'm watching, you know, one Democrat after another basically saying the numbers don't add up. Of course, this will mean a tax increase for the middle class, which means that if she's the Democratic nominee, that Donald Trump will quite accurately be able to quote other Democrats saying, of course, mm-hmm. this is going to be a massive tax increase for the middle class. And I don't know, but I, you know, running in Wisconsin or running in Michigan or Ohio or Pennsylvania on issues like, you know, abolishing fracking, taking away private health insurance and raising spending and taxes by that much does not strike me as a political winner, even among people who might want to sort of stick it to the man with a populist message.
I I absolutely agree with that. And I do, and I think that on a few issues in particular, I think that you hit the nail on the head on that fracking ban and the Green New Deal. Man, that's going overboard. And then I think if you look at this in the populist context that we're talking about, and the types of voters that we're talking to, who do they see as the other guy that they're trying to make sure they get their comeuppance? It's not really energy executives. That certainly might be the case for the environmentalist left, but they're kind of already in her camp, right? That's not these Obama Trump voters. And so I do think she's in much better territory on the kind of, if you want to call them radical, that's fine, radical kind of banking reform stuff. Then I do think the Green New Deal is going to be a problem for her. I think the jury's still out a little bit on the healthcare side of things, but the middle class tax increase for sure is going to be a threat. And look, I just want to reiterate, and I think if you look at somebody like Biden, and you look at these three categories of voters I'm talking about, the bulwarks and the Obama Trump voters and the African American voters that didn't show up, Biden appeals to all three of those categories.
Yeah, he
You know,
does.
so he's got some other issues, but there are very, on policy, he's going to appeal to the kind of suburban Republican types. On sort of cultural issues, he is of the Pennsylvania, Scranton, blue collar Trump, Obama Trump voters. They already voted for him twice. He's demonstrated in polls. He does well with African American voters, particularly older African American voters. So, and I think that is a much safer bet, no doubt. I just think that when it comes to the context of Warren, her trying to run a campaign based on Donald Trump's lies, versus really kind of leaning into her populism. I think leaning into the populism is a better bet,
Well, I
as long
guess,
as she does it
yeah.
smart. And
Okay.
by the way, doing a fracking ban is not the smart way to do it.
Okay, so I would reframe that because yeah, it's baked in. Everybody knows that Donald Trump's a liar and all of that. I keep coming back to this, and people who listen to the podcast have heard me say this 1,000 times. I'm thinking of the exhausted voter, the exhausted majority, who just will go to the polls and go, "I cannot take 4 more years of all of this. I just want a break from all of this." If Elizabeth Warren's saying, "Yes, and I will be there, and I will be ramming through a plan every single day, and I will be doing this, and I'm going to be doing this to your schools, and this to your healthcare," it's like, no, that's exhausting too. I want a break.
Yeah, and
I
that
want
voter is
grandpa. I want grandpa to sit
right.
at the desk."
And that voter is not nothing, and she was going to have a strategy for talking to them. And what that is it's a little bit less important because you're again, when you're talking to that voter, you're trying to talk to somebody who's already decided that Trump is out.
Okay.
So it's either a no vote or her. So it's only one vote switch versus flipping,
Yeah.
Obama Trump voters. That's a plus two. So there's a little more
Okay.
value there. But I hear you on the. On that part, and maybe she might need somebody out there who is saying, she has all these radical plans, but there's still going to be a Republican Senate, so you don't have to really worry about it all that much.
Yeah, that of course would be the voice inside my head, but that may be, playing the four-dimensional chess. Okay, so I want to move on. I want to talk about get to your take on Katie Hill,
Sure.
the young congresswoman who was forced to resign, but gave quite a fiery speech on the floor, and also the latest on impeachment and what we're seeing there with some of these new numbers and the interesting dynamic of the fact that not a single Republican in the House voted on a procedural bill to open up an inquiry. But first, let's get a word from our sponsor. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com. Okay, we are back with Tim Miller. Before I forget, Tim, my favorite tweet of the week, and there's so many of them.
Which one of mine?
It's Ann Coulter. Ann Coulter, did you see this one where she
was, I did.
You know, like, with something, I don't have it in front of me, but with something like, you know, for all you people who love Tulsi Gabbard. I'm getting this all wrong. Was she responding to somebody? No, somebody was ripping Tulsi Gabbard because Tulsi Gabbard voted
for supporting the impeachment vote.
Right. And then Ann Coulter snapped back at them saying, well, you know, no, she's a senator. She couldn't have done it. And everybody's putting out, no, Tulsi Gabbard is not a senator. What was great was the confidence with which Ann Coulter got it wrong. It was sort of pointless. But as far as I can tell, as of this moment, it's still up, despite the fact that she's probably got about 10 million people basically saying, no, Tulsi Gabbard is a congresswoman, not a senator. It's like, there's just no
shame. My favorite tweet was actually from Bulwark publisher Sarah Longwell, who, yeah, that's what she replied to her with that. There is just no shame in the game with Ann.
Yeah.
She's going to keep this thing up. She does not care, no matter how obviously wrong it is.
Okay, so yesterday was Thursday. For people who are listening later, the House of Representatives takes a very historic move. There's no question about it. I mean, Donald Trump is on track now to be only the third president ever to be impeached. But I can't get past the fact that not one Republican voted for this procedural bill. Now, this would strike me as an easy vote. Our friend Bill Kristol has been talking to folks, and people are saying, no, you know, basically. This was kind of a throwaway vote. There may be some of those people that might be willing to vote on substance for the impeachment, but they don't want to like tip their hand too early and then get months and months and months of being beaten up. But it really was another one of these dramatic indications of how much enthralled to Donald Trump this Republican Party is, and that you could not find one Republican anywhere in the country in the House of Representatives to vote for opening up this inquiry.
Yeah, I'm not as optimistic as Bill. I do appreciate Bill's sunny optimism. Yeah. It's nice to have that around. But, Bill talks to more of these congressmen than I do, but I talk to a few of them from time to time. And, you know, it is just we've seen this movie before, Charlie.
They all
get the courage. The news cycle is bad for Trump. People are dumping on him. He did this obviously terrible thing. You know, they're getting their courage up. They're getting excited. They're like, screw this guy. And then, you know, things start to die down. You know, the counter narrative starts to seep out there. You know, their voters are hearing from Tucker and Rush and, you know, whoever else about how much BS this all is. And they're, you know, and, you know, the rest of their caucus, you know, the people that they're talking to, you know, their peers are one by one starting to either stop responding to their texts or, you know, they see a quote that they give defending Trump publicly and everybody starts to lose their nerve again. And it seems to me like that's my until that doesn't happen once, I'm just going to continue to expect that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I do expect them to show any backbone is the triumph of hope over experience. You know, we always think in our popular culture, we think of the lone hero standing there, you know, firm. And the reality is that individual courage is extremely rare, particularly in politics. You know, you need a critical mass. And I was on a show the other day, and I sort of, you know, had this weird digression. What I said was that I'd seen a documentary where they talked to veterans of World War One. And the question was, okay, you know, when you guys were in the trenches and they blew the whistle and you went up over the top into the German machine guns, why did you do that? I mean, you're sitting there, you're watching the other wave goes and they all get killed. So why do you go? And the answer was, well, basically, it's because the guy next to me went. You know, we all went. We were all in this. And that really is kind of the nature of real political courage, right? You're looking around to make sure you're not, you know, out there by yourself, that there's some sort of, you know, collective support network. And until we get that, I don't know. I did think it was interesting this last week, though. I thought maybe some of the folks would, you know, have second thoughts watching Sean Duffy blow himself up by trying to smear Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, or watching the blowback of that clown show when they tried to storm the skiff. But this is, and because this really is part of the strategy, right? That you have this grave constitutional moment. One of the most important powers of Congress is the impeachment of the president. This really is peak congressional power. I mean, think about it. You know, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives the president the power to remove anybody in Congress, right, or the Supreme Court. Only Congress has the power to impeach and remove somebody else from a co-equal branch of government. It is an incredible power. It's incredibly, there's a certain majesty to it. And yet it's clearly in Donald Trump's interest to make it into a farce. He wants to turn the impeachment process into a circus, but circuses need clowns. So the question is, how many Senate Republicans are going to be willing to say, yes, yes, sir, I'm willing to be clown myself, like Matt Gaetz and
enough, Graham. Enough, I think, yes, you know, are willing to do it. And look, I think the other thing is that And I've written about this for the Walker a couple of times. I wrote an article about the big problem with the impeachment. You know, is a lot of these guys like to say, "Well, this is bad, but not bad enough."
Right.
You get rid of them.
Piece
right.
On that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's I think where a lot of these guys land. And I at some level I think, you know, everybody, you know, even me. Look, nobody hates Donald Trump more than me, but. I think maybe you, right? But so you tell me if you have this feeling that like the Ukraine thing is awful on every level. Everything that he did was completely inappropriate and wrong. But you know, in our lifetime, a president's never been removed. And you're talking about the majesty and the seriousness of this. And so in my brain, when I imagined a president being removed, it was always for something more, you know, I don't know, something even like more blatant and obvious, like a you know, on the criminal side of things, and this, it just feels like a bunch of idiots, you know, clumsying their way through a, you know, ham-handed criminal enterprise that yielded them nothing, and it makes you, it gives you this doubt, right? And I think that a lot of Republicans, the more the Rob Portman types, the Richard Burr types, are going to kind of play on that feeling, right? Which is like bad, but not bad enough.
And that's what,
the problem with that is.
Well, let me go over that. I mean, this is, by the way, where the play is going to go. That everybody, by the end of the process, is going to be, yes, there was a quid pro quo. He did all of that, and it's bad and it's inappropriate, but it is not, it does not rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. It is bad, but it's not impeachable, right? And so, and that's where everyone is going to end up, I think.
Yeah,
so what's wrong
I
with
agree.
That argument?
Well, my big problem with the argument is that it was the perspective nature of it, right? The president was trying to interfere in the 2020 election at some level. You know, maybe he was doing it really ham-handedly and kind of like buffoonishly, but he was targeting Joe Biden. It wasn't some random Democratic senator. It wasn't somebody, a member of the squad. It was somebody that is polling the best running against him in 2020. And he wanted to run the same playbook as 2016, which is having a foreign government interfere in the election to muddy the waters and make his opponent look as corrupt as he is. And so, and for me, you know, if you're looking at this and saying, you know, what the thing that is bad but not bad enough is Trump trying to interfere in the 2020 election, how can you then go around and say, well, but I think the 2020 election that he was trying to game is the thing that should decide whether or not he stays? It makes no sense internally. And so that's why you get a lot of these guys kind of, even though it is an absolutely bonkers, idiotic conspiracy theory, they come back to this safe space of actually he's looking into the 2016 election, right? Because that takes the perspective element off the table. And so, you know, the what I would say to the Portmans of the world who are holding that position is, what kind of message are you sending to a future more competent, you know, autocrat?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Right? You know what I mean? Like, if you're saying that it's okay to ask a foreign government to interfere in the election, in the next election, it's bad, but it's not bad enough to be impeachable, you know, your imagination doesn't have to run that wild to think about what a, you know, radical Democratic candidate could do, trying to hold up aid to Israel, or what a more competent future Trump could do. You know, somebody that isn't hiring, you know, actual political operatives, not you know, dementia-laden Rudy Giuliani to manage the scheme, right? And so I just don't understand how you can just say, okay, no punishment here. Like, let's just move on, right? And that is, That's the main problem with it. But I think that most Republicans in the Senate, if not all, are going to kind of try to brush that off.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Now, I don't want this to go to your head, Tim. But yeah. I actually have on my phone, I have a screenshot of one of your paragraphs from this article where you pointed out, you know, that the action at the heart of all of this, as you point out, is prospective. It's the blatant attempt by the president to use his office to improperly interfere with the next election. And then you wrote, how then can you argue that the judgment for improper election interference should be the very election that the perpetrator was interfering with? And this is why I screenshot it. This makes no sense. It is akin to the Tour de France saying that the verdict on Lance Armstrong's doping should be whether or not he still wins the bike race he was just caught cheating in. So, yes.
Thank you.
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay.
That does sound good. Me.
Yeah. Katie Hill, who is a young congresswoman who was, can I say that he's slut-shamed, basically, into resigning. She was going through a messy divorce, and her husband leaked out these nude pictures of her and leaked them out to a Republican operative who then posted them on a conservative website, which is sort of, you know, I suppose it is relevant. What's interesting about it is that she did resign, and she gave a speech on the floor of Congress yesterday where she basically called out the double standard and said that she was the victim of, you know, misogynistic culture. So she's leaving very, very defiantly. She said, "I am leaving, but we have men who have been credibly accused of intentional acts of sexual violence and remain in boardrooms, on the Supreme Court, in this very body, and worst of all, in the Oval Office." Wow. She's a large segment of society that fears and hates powerful women have continued to push a young woman out of power, yet a man who brags about his sexual predation sits in the highest office in the land. And so
it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, she apologized, you know, more than half a dozen times for the mistakes she made. But you know, this is really, it's being characterized as a very powerful statement about the misogynistic culture that led to her downfall. So this has got so many different twists in it. You know, it starts off with this woman with a bong and you know, tattoos and having bisexual naked pictures and stuff. And now she's like this, you know, this resistance figure. So where do you come down on the Katie Hill thing? I'm...
No, it's 2019, so I'm not going to throw judgment on bongs or, you know, bisexual consensual relationships and naked pictures. But, okay,
so I mean, this is part of the generation thing, right? Is the younger generation? I say this is an old, as in one of the old, takes pictures of everything, right? So
right. So look, here's where I land. All that stuff. I think that there's a big element of what Katie said that is accurate, and then she sort of leaves out another element. And this is the beautiful part of us, Charlie, being one of the few who are not part of Click or Tribe at this point. We can just, two things can be wrong at once, two things can be right at once. You don't have to pick every side. And so, and that's, I think, the situation here. You know, look, the revenge porn situation with her husband is disgusting, and unfortunately, this creep got everything that he wanted out of this, which was to ruin his ex-wife's life, I think that journalists and journalistic outfits should not be, you know, a party to this, right? As a general practice, you know, getting back, you know, having somebody that has a beef with another person, laundering, you know, these private pictures through news outlets is just wrong. And these news outlets need to have a hard line on this. And I feel bad for her in that case. And I think it sucks that this guy.
Yeah. I mean, you had Red State who published it. And then it seemed like for a while, everybody else was like too sleazy, not going to touch it, not going there. And then that lasted, I don't know, 24 hours?
A couple days, yeah. I think that she is in the right on that point. She is also in the right on the fact that I don't want to hear a single supporter of Donald Trump telling me that they're outraged by what Katie Hill did. I mean, as far as everything that's been reported, everything Katie Hill did was, you know, consensual. Maybe she misused her power, and I'll get to that in a second. But you know, she wasn't sexually harassing anybody or borderline raping anybody, which is what the president has been accused of on multiple occasions. She wasn't looking at teen girls against their will in a locker room while they got dressed like the president is doing. And the president's, you know, vile actions in regards to this, it's going to be a very long time before the country can actually move on and try to, you know, put in place, I think, more fair, you know, policies around sexual harassment in a political setting because of just the vast hypocrisy of the two of the last four presidents having very extreme indiscretions and being, you know, given a pass by their supporters. So she's right on all that. The problem is that she had a completely inappropriate affair with somebody that worked for her, and that it was that person that also blew the whistle. So there were two, you know, there are two things happening at once here. Members of Congress, you know, can't be sleeping with people that work on their staffs, young people, and they certainly can't be putting them in very uncomfortable positions in trying to, have sex with them, which is what the staffer says that, you know, Katie did. And so as far as I'm concerned, you can just say, hey, you know, she has to resign for that action. It's wrong. While at the same time, it is really unfortunate. And there is a double standard in conservative media in the way that they've treated her and that, you know, these outlets should not be letting her, you know, use these private pictures against her. Like, both those things can be true at once. It's a shitty situation.
That is a great take. And that is refreshing because you're right. Two things can be true at the same time. And I guess the question is, you know, if this was a male congressman under the exact same circumstances, would they also be forced to resign? And they think the answer is because of that last element, having sex with a member of her staff. The answer would be yes. So,
yeah, I mean, Wiener had to resign. Mm-hmm. I forget what happened around Joe Barton. He had some pictures out, and I think he volunteered. I forget whether he was pressured to resign or whether he just, you know, was part of the Texodus out of the Congress.
Gone, right?
But yeah, he's gone though. You know, so it seems to me that yes. Al Franken, and there have been plenty of examples of men who've been forced to resign. Now, the president of the United States being a very, very, very pretty important and influential counterexample to this. I think on balance, it is the case.
Okay, so there's some criticism from folks of Nancy Pelosi's comments who, you know, basically said that, you know, that this was a lesson that everybody ought to be more careful, that, you know, even kindergartners should be told, you know, do not have these naked pictures, that sort of thing. And people are pushing back saying, you know, that being careful won't prevent revenge porn. And then Nancy Pelosi seemed to imply that it was partially her fault. I guess this is I'm more sympathetic to the Nancy Pelosi position is that here's an example. I mean, people need to understand that some of this behavior, you know, is going to come back in the future, and it will have a devastating effect on lots of folks, you know, millennials and younger, who want to have public, you know, want to have, you know, political careers and be engaged in all of this. Or who knows, maybe just the norms are going to change so dramatically that, you know, 20 years from now, it's going to be nothing. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that when somebody admitted that they'd smoked marijuana, that would be disqualifying. Now it would be like,
it's not that long.
Yeah. But now it seems like, it, you know, a complete footnote, but, it is an interesting moment of the intersection of sex and power and technology and generational, issues and some of the fallout of the Me Too generation. I mean, the Me Too movement, which is, shall we say, unpredictable and uneven in its applications.
For sure. And, you know, as far as Pelosi, I definitely think there's a generational element to this. I understand the point that she was making, but I think the critics would rightly say that, you know, she was really putting a lot of the blame, you know, right on the person who was wronged in the situation with again, just in the one element of the situation, which is with regards to the revenge porn, where she was wronged. And I think that it is, in some of these instances, you know, I think that Pelosi is right to say that we need to start teaching kids when they're younger that, like, all this stuff stays around forever. All the stuff that you're putting out on the internet and can get screenshotted and can stay around forever. That is an important lesson. But on the other hand, you know, Katie Hill was in a consensual relationship. She was married, right? And so, you know, there's not, in theory, you know, anything wrong with, you know, what, you know, sharing, you know, pictures with her husband. And you know, I don't think she should have had this expectation that her husband would have been able to, you know, get back at her through revenge porn, and then everybody say, oh, it was your fault for sending your husband these pics in the first, you know, I can see why the critics of Nancy would, you know, would have tried to point out that maybe she sort of missed that element of it in her. Congresswoman.
It does perhaps suggest that perhaps she has bad judgment in husbands. But then again, you
know, I mean, maybe
who are we to talk about that? So Tim Miller,
president's on his third swing on that front.
Well, also in the naked pictures, I just, you know, I mean, I don't, okay, you know what? I'm not even going to go there. It's just,
I think we already went too far. It's the weekend pod. Naked pictures.
There was one of those moments. There were so many moments that were at the time they occurred. I'd look around and go, this isn't a huge thing, but it gets completely lost. I just remember, in fact, like, you know, for example, I'm sorry, now I'm sort of interrupting myself. We had Amanda Carpenter on a little while ago, and, you know, she was talking about when Trump World smeared her in the National Enquirer, and Trump World, you know, smeared her for having an affair with Ted Cruz. And I remember this was right before the Wisconsin primary. This was a big, big, big thing, and then it completely disappeared. And it's almost like this tiny little blip. But at the time, it was a huge element of this campaign, and it was an indication of you know, obviously a lot of other things that were going on. And I just remember right before the 2016 election, I think it was the New York Post. It was a major publication, and I will apologize if I'm getting this wrong, ran some very racy pictures of Melania Trump. I mean, they were softcore porn. And I remember at the time thinking, look, this would not have happened if Donald Trump himself did not want this to happen. This would not, and he did not object to it. And I thought, this is an amazing moment where Donald Trump is calculating that this is in his interest to do this, and is actually, as part of a presidential campaign, is kind of pimping out these pictures of his sexy wife naked. And yet there was almost no, and people didn't know how to process it, how to even do this sort of thing. And so, I don't know, it's...
We could do a whole nother pod on that.
But we are in this world where there are actually no real standards anymore, are there? I mean, it's just like, you know, does this help my tribe or does it hurt my tribe? Which hat am I going to wear today? What am I going to be outraged about? What am I going to be caring about? Which values are the ones I'm going to, you know, fight and die for? And which ones are completely contingent on what I need to win this news cycle? I mean, we really are in this stage of radical moral relativism, aren't we?
I don't know how I could even argue or add on that point,
that was,
Charles.
That was too much. Tim Miller, thank you for joining me on one of our special, well, they're all special, weekend podcasts. I appreciate it very, very much.
Anytime, Charles.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. The episode today was brought to you by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday morning, and we will do this all over again.